This is a 720 to go podcast from Chicago's WGN Radio 720.
This podcast is sponsored by ADM.
As one of the world's largest agricultural processors, ADM is uniquely positioned to serve the world's growing needs for abundant food and renewable energy. ADM.
When it comes to the business of America's farmland, you need the information from the people who know it best. That's why we bring you AgriCast with Orion Samuelson and Max Armstrong.
Well, thank you very much, and good morning to you, Roger. And we always say good morning, world, because we never know where people are listening, thanks to our streaming capability, and always interesting to hear from people on different continents and different countries, and we welcome that. And it's good to know that they're hearing WGN Radio. But it's good to have you with us here in the Midwest. Been kind of a rainy day. We got, in my rain gauge here in Huntley, Illinois, in McHenry County, yesterday, 0.89 inches of rain, less than an inch, but nice little shower. And as you hear Jim Fazell, when he joins us here on the show, we talk about how quickly it'll dry up after rains have ended. And that was certainly the case again, because before yesterday's showers, lawn was turning pretty brown. But anyway, this morning we're going to check in with Bryce Knorr of Farm Futures Magazine. Max will be talking to him about the current grain market situation. And we're going to talk about an organization that's been around for four decades now, Illinois Agricultural Leadership Foundation. Current president and CEO Lee Strom will sit down with us in the studio in just a minute or two, and we're going to talk about what's going on with that organization. At 9 minutes after 5 o'clock, all of that coming up when we continue on the Saturday morning show. The Illinois Agricultural Leadership Foundation has been around for a few decades now. I was fortunate enough to be in on the beginning, and that's when Joyce Watson served as founder of the foundation. But now we have Lee Strom, who is the president and CEO of the Leadership Foundation, and you're doing a good job, Lee. I'm glad to see it.
Well, thank you, Orion. It's a pleasure to be back in connection with the Illinois Ag Leadership Foundation and its great program of work. As you mentioned, you've been involved a long time. I was very fortunate to be a participant back in the 1980s, in the class of 1988. And from my own personal experience, that was a life-changing experience, that 2 years being involved in that program. It, as a farm kid and farming at the time, it opened my eyes to a broader spectrum of issues and how to handle them, not just on a local level, but nationally and internationally as well. And it had an influence on my career path. And now I'm fortunate and honored to have this opportunity to be the new CEO and president of the organization. I came on board last fall.
One of the interesting things about the foundation is I discovered many of the members had not taken a foreign trip before, but you recently returned from this class's foreign trip. Where did you go? What did you do?
In early March, this current class, there were 29 individuals in the class, and I accompanied them to Southeast Asia. We first arrived in the city of Hong Kong, where we spent just a couple of days. But as tradition with these trips, our very first hours on the ground in a country like that or a region, we try to meet with our U.S. officials. So we were with the U.S. consulate office that first morning, and then that afternoon we had a great visit with the gentleman who's the head of investment banking for J.P. Morgan. And then we toured the port facility there. You know, that's one of the more bustling ports in the Pacific Rim area. And then from Hong Kong, we traveled on and spent about five, six days in Vietnam. We first flew directly to Hanoi in the north part of the country. We met with our U.S. ambassador and other U.S. high-level officials there and had a great tour of that region of the world. From Hanoi, we then traveled south to Saigon, where we spent another 3 days in Saigon. Today it's called Ho Chi Minh City, with the unification of Vietnam after the Vietnam War. It was really an interesting visit there. We saw some agribusinesses there that are operating. So we were out in the rural area, saw some of their agricultural practices, and also had cultural visits intertwined with those other key visits. From Saigon, then we traveled back over to Taiwan, the island of Taiwan, and we flew into Taipei in the city region. Again, first met with our U.S. American Institute folks there, which is our government offices there in Taiwan. Because Taiwan's very unique relationship with China. It has an independence from China, but China is very interested in having it brought into the fold more under its influence. So we have an American Institute there of Taiwan, where our government officials reside. But then we had very extensive visits across the Taiwanese countryside. We went down the western coast of the country. There are key agricultural areas, and it's amazing. They use every square foot of available land for agricultural production. But they're also significant importers, as were all of these places we touched base. And then we flew out of Kaohsiung, Taiwan, back to the U.S. We were gone about 14 days, a extremely interesting experience. And as you mentioned, there was a number of this class, too, that had not been outside the borders of the U.S. But for them and all those that were participating in this class, it was a real eye-opening experience.
Thing we can never forget is 95% of the world's population lives outside the United States, so we're dependent on those countries to buy.
Well, right, and one of the key, in referencing the geography of this region, when we were in Hong Kong, and we heard this in several of the presentations there, Hong Kong, within a five-hour flight, airplane ride, from Hong Kong resides half of the world's population. And that does not include the bulk of the country of India. So it's a stunning realization that with China and the Pacific Rim Islands and countries in that area resides, again, half of the world's population. Tremendous market opportunities. I know you and others were there decades ago as those borders in relations with many of those regions were opened up. But there's still promising work to be done there to open those markets even further.
I'll never forget my first visit to all of the places you mentioned, but particularly Vietnam. Corn Growers sponsored that tour, and primary purpose at that time was to get the Vietnamese farmers involved in nutrition programs using American corn. But the two things I particularly remember is I survived the motor scooters and the bicycles, didn't get killed by any of them. And then I stood in the cell where John McLean spent 6 years of his life and never forgotten.
Yes, you're speaking of the Hanoi Hilton in Hanoi, and right in downtown in the city of Hanoi. And yes, we that was one of our cultural visits, and I think a very meaningful visit, realizing that, Orion, today these members of these classes of the Illinois Ag Leadership, which range in age from 25 to 45 years old, many of them, most of them, not all of them, were not even born at the time of the conclusion of the Vietnam War. So they see it. This generation sees it through a bit of a different lens. And when you travel Vietnam, you realize the vast majority of that population is under 50 years old as well. So, you know, it's a generation removed now from the experience of those conflicts, but it's still important to understand how these events over the last 100 years have shaped relations today. We found the Vietnamese people, and I think without exception, all of our group would say that the Vietnamese people were very welcoming, very interested to engage with us, very warm and accommodating to all of our needs, and provided us a wonderful experience. The population, the people there, are very interested in engaging with it. Realizing, again, there's only one of five remaining communist countries in the world, so you have the Communist Party overseeing all this, but the population is extremely warm, welcoming, and engaging with us.
So now let's come back to the United States, because you have just recently selected the class members of the upcoming class. Give me an idea who is applying and who is being accepted and what they do and who they represent company-wise.
Well, Orion, again, as you know, every 2 years we go through this process, and we did. We had an application period that was open late winter, early spring. We closed that period. We had a wonderful group of applicants, again, for this program. I think now going on soon its fourth decade of existence, because the first class of 1984 is more 35 years ago. Yeah. So we span four decades. As the program has evolved, there is increasing interest for participants to want to be involved. I think they see the quality of the program. And I give much credit to my predecessors, Joyce Watson and Don Norton, who really raised the bar in this, and we're continuing to look at ways we can create better experiences for the participants. But these class members, we had to choose 30, that's the difficult part. We had great applicants. We selected 30. We have 23 men, 7 women, who span the agricultural and agribusiness spectrum here in Illinois. I think one of the things that is really interesting as well is the involvement of agriculture over the last several decades. And with now much interest of our city brethren about what goes on the farm and really wanting to engage in the local food systems that are going on, our applicants and are the 30 individuals we selected come from small agriculture, local agriculture, all the way through to the more larger farms, larger operations, and the agribusiness sector, from smaller companies to our major companies here in Illinois. It spans the whole spectrum. We even have a few applicants that come out of the city of Chicago and other metropolitan areas who have agribusiness-related opportunities. And that important feature of bringing together our true farmer representatives in the class, I think this one has been the really goals of the program, is bring together different perspectives, bring open discussion to the group that can really provide an educational experience that is unmatched, and leadership development experience that is unmatched anywhere else in Illinois or, we believe, across the country.
Well, you were a farm boy, but you ended up running the Farm Credit Administration, and I would guess the experience in the foundation program helped you in that job.
Absolutely, Orion. It was one of those, I guess I'd say, aha moments for me, because, 30 years ago, in our national travel segment, one of the key seminars of this is we take our classes to Washington, D.C. 30 years ago, the class I participated in, we had a visit with Paul Volcker, at that time chair of the Federal Reserve. 25 years later, here back in 2008 in 2009, while I was chairing the Farm Credit Administration and chief executive officer there, during the height of the Great Recession, we had several issues, and I found myself in actual business meetings in the boardroom of the Federal Reserve to discuss issues that were affecting the economy and the agricultural sector. It was those experience and knowledge and confidence I gained as a participant in this program 30 years ago that gave me the realization that it was appropriate for me. I had been trained, and the leadership experience I had gained through this program provided me the ability to sit with my peers, in essence, other government leaders in Washington, D.C. during my time there. And it was a wonderful opportunity.
Finally, when does the current class come together for the first time, or has it already come together?
Well, the first actual gathering where they were meeting and greet each other for the first time is going to be on August 24th and 25th. That is our orientation seminar, where we bring the new class together for the first time, then we all get introduced, we lay out the groundwork for the next a series of seminars that will span the next 19 months beyond August. And also tied, that's a two-day seminar, but it will also include another key component this year. On the evening of August 25th, that's a Saturday evening, we will also be having the Torch Awards, the Torch of Leadership Awards ceremonies held in Bloomington. Our seminar session is going to be in Bloomington. Part of it will be held on the campus of Illinois State University. But that Saturday evening, leaders from around the state will gather for every other year we present Torch of Leadership Awards. This year they're going to 4 individuals who are certainly have demonstrated leadership in their careers, and we honor them by presenting them a very nice award and a very nice evening celebration.
Lee, I'm glad you are where you are, because I know the foundation will grow under your leadership. Visit this morning with Lee Strom, who is the president and CEO of the Illinois Agricultural Leadership Foundation, on the Saturday Morning Show. It's 25 minutes after 5 o'clock here on the Saturday Morning Show. As always, we appreciate your company, your joining us here on WGN Radio Chicago. Yesterday, the monthly cattle on feed report came out from the U.S. Department of Agriculture. No major surprises. As a matter of fact, the numbers pretty much in line with expectations by traders in livestock futures at the Chicago Mercantile Exchange. So no surprises there. Coming up on the Saturday Morning Show, a guest we haven't visited with for a long time, Bryce Knorr, who is with Farm Futures Magazine as their senior grain analyst. And he'll be sharing his views and opinions on crop conditions and those weekly crop progress reports. And, of course, something that overrides everything, not only in the world of agriculture, but in the world. And that's the ongoing talk of trade wars between China and the United States and other trading partners as well. President Trump has decided they've taken advantage of the United States for too long, and he wants to level the playing field. So we'll see how that progresses as next week comes up. Oh, this week I received my first email with a question I have been getting every year for years and decades. When is the sandwich fair? And I keep telling you, forever, sandwich fair, Sandwich, Illinois, always starts the Wednesday after Labor Day. So the Wednesday after Labor Day will be opening day for the Sandwich Fair at Sandwich, Illinois. And we plan to be there. Max will be there on the opening day, Wednesday. And I'll be there on Thursday, along with the band on the outdoor stage. So we'll be at the Sandwich Fair a couple of days in the first week of September. Also, I'll be heading to the Illinois State Fair. Agriculture Day is the 14th, and I'll be down there to emcee the sale of grand champions once again at the Illinois State Fair on the 14th of August. And then on Saturday night, the 25th, Sangamon County Farm Bureau celebrates its 100th anniversary. 100 years ago, that farmers with some vision saw the need for an organization that could represent their interests, not only in Sangamon County, but across the country. And so their 100th anniversary meeting and banquet will be held at the Orr Building at the Illinois State Fairgrounds on Saturday, August 25. So I look forward to being there with you for all of that. And as I said, Bryce Knorr of the Farm Futures Magazine will be joining us shortly. He and Max sat down in our studio this week and talked a lot about market activity and trade wars and retaliation and tariffs and all that. So interesting visit with a man who's covered it for years and years and decades. Looks like we're going to continue to have showery weather across the Midwest. And yesterday, as I said, and in my rain gauge in Huntley, Illinois here, 80.89 inches of rain. Not quite an inch, but showers that fell throughout the day. We are at the 5:30 mark here on the Saturday Morning Show. Thank you, Roger. At 25 minutes before 6 o'clock, Oh, I do have to share with you something that we did yesterday, because we had lunch with Lee Strom at Jameson's at Sun City Huntley, which is where Gloria and I spend a lot of our time. And when we were seated at our table, there was another couple that was at the next table, and they handed Gloria a note. And the note said that they lived near the Poplar Grove Airport in northern Illinois, where Air Orion used to park all the time, and that they were steady listeners and that they were happy to be sitting next to us at Jameson's. And the folks at Jameson's tell me that very often people will say, well, is our Orion and Gloria here? And if we are, we're happy to say hello and to meet you. And I like the note that the couple sent from Poplar Grove. They said, we love this place too. Well, so do we. So thanks for introducing yourselves and joining us in a little conversation. Right now, it's time for Samuelson Says. That's sponsored by Wink Products Company, makers of quality specialty cleaning products since 1947. And I am Orion, and this week, finally saying milk is really milk. Finally, after much too long a time, I have a definition of a product that I've been consuming since I arrived on the planet. Milk. The definition of milk is provided by Scott Gottlieb of the Food and Drug Administration a few days ago. The definition, it comes from the milking of one or more healthy cows. We've been going through what can be called milk and what should not be called milk for a long time, particularly with the advent of milk made from other products like soybeans and almond. But FDA Commissioner Scott Gottlieb talked about the plans this week, noting there are hundreds of federal standards of identity spelling out how foods with various names need to be manufactured. The question becomes, have we been enforcing our own standard of identity? Gottlieb said about milk that the answer is probably not. And, of course, there are other products that the officials and consumers continue to argue about. Standards of identity have been the source of industry disagreements as American diets have evolved, including fights about what gets to be called mayonnaise and yogurt. But now we know the definition of milk. It's the definition that I've said for a long time. Milk comes from female bovines, and it also comes from goats and sheep, but it's milk. And now I no longer have to say I never sat under an almond tree and milked it. I never sat next to a soybean plant and milked it. Of course, not everybody agreed with that. The National Milk Producers Federation certainly did, saying that the labeling practices of plant-based dairy imitators violated federal standards. But the Good Food Institute said, for the same reason you can have gluten-free bread, almond milk and soy milk are the most clear and best terms for describing those products. I don't think so. My thoughts on Samuelson Says. A presentation of Tribune Radio Networks. And here on the Saturday morning show at 20 minutes before 6 o'clock, we're going to be checking in with Max Armstrong and Bryce Knorr when we continue here on the Saturday morning show.
In the studio with us this weekend, grain market analyst Bryce Knorr with Farm Futures. It's been a while, and it's good to see you back.
Well, good to see you, Max.
The last time we talked, we weren't looking at the depths of a market that's been under pressure the way this one has for the past couple of months. We're not seeing much sign of life at the moment, are we?
Well, I think there are some positive indications, particularly for wheat. maybe for corn. And I think you can make an argument that soybeans, if they haven't made a bottom, they don't have a terrible lot of downside to them. Whether or not they have much upside is really going to depend on yield. But the world wheat situation, it's tightening. These stocks-to-use ratios of the major exporters is basically as low as it's ever been in history, at least dating back to the 1960. That's the data I have. So there's hopes that that's kind of going to elevate wheat prices around the world, and that'll lift our market as well.
Refresh our memory. What has helped bring this wheat supply in line with the demand? Crop problems?
Well, crop problems here in the U.S., the farmers are just planting less wheat historically. But we have an average crop, average sort of yields, but lower acres. And around the world, France had too much rain, kind of spoiled some of their crop. Mm-hmm. It's been very dry in Germany up through the Baltics. They produce higher protein wheat, and so they have a short crop. And then even going down to the Black Sea area, Ukraine, Russia, they're having some problems as well. Not a total disaster by any means, but just lower production, lower acres. But the big place with a target on it right now is Australia due to the developing El Nino. Farmers planted their crop in May into some of the driest soils in memory. And so it looks like they're going to be having a short crop.
And they are, in most years, a major wheat exporter.
Right. And, of course, it's a small country, not a lot of people. They don't eat much wheat, so they have to export it.
What's your feeling about the wheat acreage in the United States? Will our growers, especially of the soft red wheat, the hard red wheat in the plain states, first and foremost, will they boost acreage this fall?
I think they probably will, just because it may be the best of a bad lot, and they may think that the wheat market, when it starts trending higher, tends to keep going for a couple years. So I think people may be encouraged by that. The guys with cattle, if the price isn't good, they can always just graze it out and get some forage that way as well. So they have a few alternatives there. It's also going to depend on moisture. It's been very dry in parts of Kansas, and that's they're shriveling up their corn and soybean crops in those areas. So it may depend on whether or not they get those August-September rains. Typically, they do in these El Nino fall years.
Since you're talking about dry weather, that dry area of eastern Kansas extends over into western Missouri, northwest Missouri. Very dry there, I know. Give us a feel for the Corn Belt at this stage of the game and what the moisture looks like out there. Are there other dry pockets? How significant is the dryness? How significant has the heat been in perhaps taking some of the top off of the corn yield?
Well, that dry pocket from eastern Kansas over really to western Illinois, but ground zero is in Missouri. Their crop has been devastated. We do have a feature called Feedback from the Field. Farmers file their reports. So people have been talking about that now for a while.
I think, a fourth of the Missouri corn crop is rated poor or very poor now.
Right. Just in the past week, my yield estimate dropped 14 bushels, which is a startling drop.
For the state of Missouri.
Yeah, for the state of Missouri. Other places like Iowa, the crop overall is decent, but some places are too wet, some places are too dry, and that's kind of a pattern around the Corn Belt. Michigan has been dry. They're one of the top 10 producers, so looks like their yields are going to be down. Illinois, by and large, except for that those few dry areas, looks like they're going to have a bumper crop. And when you start moving up into the northwest part of the Corn Belt, Minnesota and the Dakotas, things look very good. So they're going to, looks like the yields up there could offset some of the problems elsewhere.
So the Dakotas are in pretty good shape then.
Right. They have a lot of green on the vegetation health index maps, but we have kind of a dichotomy. The crop ratings have been coming down that USDA puts down every week on
Monday.
Which
you would expect this time of year.
Right.
They usually do start.
Typically they, and then right around now, they either keep going or they turn higher. Now, I also look at the Vegetation Health Index, and I have a model that estimates corn and soybean yields based on that. And the corn yields have been, they've been saying the yield maybe 171, 174, basically about average, where those crop ratings are still 177 to 180. So I think we're going to find out here pretty quickly just which way this corn crop is going, and that could have a big impact on prices.
After the experience of 2017, how much do you correlate the weekly crop rating reports with the yield of the corn crop?
Well, by October, they actually do a fairly good job. Early in the year, there's a lot of error still baked into the model, so you have to take that into account.
But when we got the August report last year, we got a surprise, did we not?
Right, and then the yield kept getting bigger and bigger and bigger. And remember, we wound up with, what, over 176 bushels per acre, an all-time record yield. Some years the crop ratings do a good job, other years not so much. It's one of the ways that I look at just what's happening to the crop. Again, we use the Vegetation Health Index models. At the end of July, we'll be able to crank numbers into a weather model that does a pretty good job. And then we also ask farmers for their yield estimates, both in our surveys and in this feedback from the field feature, which actually came fairly close, but you had to wait for corn. You had to wait until farmers actually harvested the crop in October, November, and then they were able to give an accurate assessment. Early on, farmers tend to be very conservative. Everybody's growing 150 bushel corn. By the time they get it in the way wagon, in the bin, it's up to 200.
Many were pleasantly surprised last year, realistically. Not just a low-balling estimate, but many were genuinely surprised, were they not, Bryce?
Right. We had a long period for grain fill, and that could be, that's one of the things that kind of people are chattering about now with the fast development of the crop. If the crop keeps on developing, that may shorten the grain fill period. Now, looks like the forecast into early August is kind of cool, but a little dry. That may extend that grain fill. Most places have pretty good soil moisture. So it's still kind of a jump ball as to which way this is going to trend. The market will pay a lot of attention to USDA's August 10th crop report that features the results of their first survey of farmers in the field.
When will you come out with your number prior to the August report?
Well, we're doing our survey right now, so we will be reporting that August 3rd. Give everybody about a week heads up on just what USDA may say.
In your mind, where's the corn yield now? What are you thinking? What have you been talking?
I'm thinking probably about average. Your USDA put it at 174. I'm a little lower than that, 172 and change. Right now, I think that's probably where we're at.
Is the trade thinking a little higher than that?
The trade has been looking at the crop ratings. So they started off, more 180 plus. They're starting to come down a little bit, I think. And you're just starting now with the noise about trade starting to calm down a little bit. People are really starting to focus on the yield number, which is something they typically obsess about much more, but we've been distracted.
Is it too early to talk about a soybean yield, knowing how much that crop can get a boost in August or be hurt in August by developing dryness that continues to worsen in any particular area?
Well, we can talk about it. Now, the talk may not mean anything because soybeans are so notoriously difficult to predict. The crop ratings have a lot of error baked into them for soybeans.
At this stage of the game.
Right, until we get to really into late August, September, October. Then they do a fairly good job. Right now, they only account for about 30% of the variability in the final yield, which is statistically significant, but not good at all in terms of trying to figure out where the yield is at. I'm figuring the yield is probably 50 bushels per acre right now, but a lot can change.
That would be an average yield, would it not?
Yeah, that would be probably a little above average. And if we do get to 50, that would be 6 years in a row of above average yields.
You mentioned just a minute or so ago that the trade tariff talk has calmed down a little bit. It is not the market factor now, or it's not moving the market the way it was as the market was falling
Well, we just haven't had any headlines break on it for a little while. Of course, as soon as you say that, something will happen.
Right.
And it'll come back into the headlines. So it's kind of like lightning or waves. When they crash, and then they recede for a little bit, and we can kind of focus on the stuff that we normally talk about.
Is the bearishness not all factored in already? I mean, how much more could the markets fall based on trade war talk?
Well, the USDA put the bottom of its average cash price range, July 12th, was $8.
That was surprisingly high to some folks.
Well, you know, you can. I think you can probably talk futures with a $7 handle at some point. If the crop does come in, say 50 bushels per acre, I think we'll probably go down there and test that. But we're still going to be selling a lot of soybeans. People around the world are still going to need them. And we're still dealing with the after effects of the short crop in Argentina.
Always interesting to hear from Bryce Knorr, the senior grain analyst with Farm Futures Magazine, where I'm sure many of you read what he has to say. But always interesting, and we thank Bryce Knorr for spending time with Max here on the Saturday Morning Show.
Visiting this week with another BASF Technical Service Representative, Gary Welker, has joined us different times here during the growing season. We want to check in with him again there in the northern part of the Hoosier State. Gary, what are you seeing? What are you noticing with the fields out there? Are we in need of a rain yet in some of the areas you serve?
Oh, yeah. Northwest Indiana, I mean, was looking great for a long time, but and we still have some great-looking corn, but we've missed some of these rains in pockets that occurred over the last couple weeks. So there's some guys that got relief, you know, over the weekend and Monday, and other guys are still waiting for that, you know, relief on the drought conditions that are starting to set in. Kind of similar to the area I cover in Illinois, but, you know, those are a little bit heavier soils, so they have a little more buffer in, you know, waiting for rain to occur.
I made the comment to a banker friend of mine. Now, he was in southern Illinois as we were visiting, and I asked him if we've trimmed some of the corn yield potential with this kind of heat, especially at night that we've seen, and with some dry conditions, and he offered the opinion that maybe we had trimmed the yield on both corn and beans. What's your view of that?
Probably on corn, you know, that above 70 degree nighttime temperature, you know, after pollination is obviously not good when you're trying to start putting, you know, some starches into the kernels. But soybeans, you know, again, there's lots of time on soybeans because for the most part we're at R3, maybe some soybeans are at R4, so we got a lot of time yet. So, you know, we'll get some rains. The heat doesn't seem to bother soybeans near as much. You know, they're a C3 plant versus C4 there. So I have lots of hope for big yields on soybeans yet, obviously depending on what happens from now on as far as rain is concerned.
And let's talk a bit about using the fungicides yet over these crops. What's your view about the benefits of still seeing some improvement perhaps in plant health and then ultimately assisting the yield?
Corn is probably getting at the tail end because most corn is starting to get probably close to R3. But soybeans, you know, that's the right time for making, you know, the preventive applications once soybeans get to R3. So a little refresher course there is when soybeans have a 3/16 of an inch pod in the four uppermost nodes, that's when they're in R3. So lots of applications have occurred probably for the last 10 days, and I think there'll be, you know, opportunities for making applications in what we call the sweet spot, R3, is yet to occur. So, again, there's some dry conditions out, so guys are like, well, there's not much disease out there, why should I do this? What they have to remember is, you know, Pyraxor for soybeans and even Headline Amp for corn is not just a fungicide. It has some other attributes that are real important. And those are part of what we call the three pillars of plant health. So besides disease control, we have stress mitigation and growth efficiency improvement. So even when there's low disease pressure years, we still see, you know, advantages to making those applications in both corn and soybeans. And it's because of the plant health benefits, not necessarily about the disease control. You know, and even though disease might be low right now, you know, it takes one weather event and we turn back into getting lots of rains and high humidity, and then what diseases are in the field, they just explode. So preventative is the way to do that, and those are historically make that application in soybeans when you're at R3.
And the words I caught there that you shared, stress mitigation, certainly that could apply in times when we miss some rains and we're into drier conditions, I trust.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we've done these studies where we take soybeans and put them in pots, and then, you know, we get them growing, and then we'll, you know, make an application or not make an application, and then we put them under drought conditions and then watch them start to deteriorate, and then we relieve that stress with some watering. Well, the ones that have had cracks or applications, they recover really quick, and the ones that didn't take a lot longer to recover. So that's what we mean by stress mitigation. You know, if it quits raining forever, yeah, you're in trouble, but if it recovers from, you know, one of those thunderstorms that comes through, it recovers quicker and it can move on with the rest of the season as far as the soybean is concerned.
I watch tweets closely this time of year to try to keep a handle on what's going on with field conditions, and I noted a picture that was posted by a certified crop advisor the other day, a woman, and I don't believe she has any particular affiliation with any company. She was showing a corn leaf, and I don't know if it was gray leaf spot or what she was depicting there, but she said it is a strong testimony for utilizing fungicides in the field. Have we been seeing some gray leaf spot?
Oh, yeah. I mean, gray leaf spot. Yeah, because we were relatively moist conditions, high humidity, warm conditions. That's just perfect conditions for gray leaf spot. So you can't step into a soybean field or cornfield in my geography and not see a fair amount of gray leaf spot. And in some cases, it's all the way up to the ear zone and even above it. So hopefully this, everybody's made their applications in a timely manner when it comes to corn, because again, it just takes high humidity conditions, and gray leaf spot just explodes.
In that area you serve, is the corn crop pretty well made now? I mean, would that general summary apply, or are we still in that fill period where weather can really make a difference?
We still need to get some improved conditions in some spots, because, you know, we're, call it late milks starting at dough, so we got a ways to go, and if it, in the places that haven't got any rain, don't get some relief from that, you know, we're going to start aborting some kernels and stuff like that. You know, you move over into the heavier soils in western Indiana, or you get into Illinois, you know, that's a good crop already, you know, with what we got, and a few rains turns it into a great crop.
And our thanks for the weekly report from the folks at BASF on crop conditions across the Midwest. And my thanks to you for joining us here every Saturday morning for the Saturday Morning Show. I want to thank Bob Ferguson, the engineer, for putting it all together for me, and thank you for listening.
Orion Samuelson keeps you connected to the world of business and agriculture on WGN. Hear his reports weekday mornings on the Steve Cochran Show and during the noon hour on the Wintrust Business Lunch. Plus, catch Orion and Max on Saturday mornings at 5 a.m. only on Chicago's WGN Radio 720.